coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this evening's special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Chris Jordan here, coming to you from Austin, Texas. We have a great show lined up for you tonight. In the second half, we will be talking with our good friend Mike Turber about the concept of vetting in the world of security, in the world of UFO, UAP research, and any research, and specifically in relation to the recent Lou Elizondo episode, where he showed a picture of a chandelier in the reflection of a window saying it was a mothership. This was a picture that was supplied to him by a friend in the world of security. So it's one of those, at what point do you start questioning your vetted sources? At what point do you continue vetting your vetted sources? So huge conversation to have on this topic right now in the UFO UAP community. Our guest in the first segment will be our good friend Jared Murphy, as well as Christy Bass. They are from Archeo X. We will be talking about a recent trip to Belize that they made, uncovering an amazing temple complex, as well as the work, the continuing work that they are doing in the area with aerial mapping, all kinds of things to uncover this. Let's take a quick look at this reel that they provided.
This is a massive pyramid structure in sight. It's not just one pyramid, it's multiple mounds with multiple buildings, multiple constructions over multiple acres. It's massive.
Welcome back to the show, Jared Murphy, and welcome for the first time, Christy Bass. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
It is great having you on the show. It's been fantastic talking with you in the pre-show conversation, and it is absolutely exciting to me. We had had conversations prior to your trip to Belize. I was supposed to go on the trip to Belize with you the first time around, Jared, and to see this sizzle reel, to see the amazing things that y'all have found on location out here, absolutely gobsmacked and mind-blowing, man. Congratulations. It's been a long road for you to come to this point even. Let's start off with how did you come to this journey to begin with, Jared? How did you come to find out about this location, and how did you come to getting the permits and the required licensing to do all of this excavation and digging?
The short answer for people busy is a miracle.
Yeah.
And that's a short answer. The longer answer is, all along from the time you and I ever started, talking from the launch of my book, I had just come back from being in South Africa with Michael Tellinger for a month. And the goal was to not just write about our mysterious and ancient past and why it doesn't seem to align, why it doesn't seem to, whatever we've been told is just not the human past that exists in the ruins even, and the technologies that are on the ground. So I wanted to go on endeavors where we could go in the field and apply our existing sciences and technologies to discover not only our recent dynastic past, you know, most of the past that's in the last 12,000 years that we think are, well, outside of the Sumerians and the Egyptians and the Aztecs and the Mayans, it's all considered primitive. But the idea was, could we go on the field, apply current satellite technologies, LIDAR technologies, aerial LIDAR technologies, could we apply all the stuff that we know of today to sites in a way that was outside of an academic setting, and actually rediscover and also reapply some of the technologies that might be hidden either in the ruins or in what I suspect are biotechnical systems that are mistaken for natural or biological. I mean, things we've talked about before, including the Terra Preta. So we ended up going to Belize because there was a private property owner that suspected they had ruins on the site. We were able to, day one, not only prove that on our first expedition, but actually put the property owner on the trail of a massive archaeological theft site, probably worth millions.
Wow.
And that was a really, it was a really good feeling to target what we thought were from our satellite imaging to what could have been ancient Mayan sites to helping locate what were actual sites. We were very successful the first time out. So when we went a second time, we had done it after meeting a village and a mayor who was very motivated to uncover what is a massive ruin site in the country. And after not just going after what we had as personal goals for what would become ArchaeoX, but for me to meet people that are going to be all, I think are going to be pretty typical when we go to Peru or when we go anywhere else in the world, we're going to find current human lives living on what are likely significant, not just dynastic sites, but on the mysteries of the world. And in this case, we got lucky. We met the right mayor who wanted to bring work to his village. And we were able to coordinate with him and local government and national government. And we were lucky enough as a private business to be able to put together a group, including Christy. And we were able to go and work on 8 pyramids and start work that we hope to continue into the future and then around the world. It was pretty exciting.
That is absolutely awesome and exciting, man. And once again, to have seen this project come to fruition, to have seen everything from the ground up come to this, it is awesome to see the culmination happening, Jared. And Christy, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved with ArchaeoX yourself.
Yeah, so I work for an aerial mapping company, and I got a phone call from another partner of ours. He was interested in doing aerial LIDAR over the area. And so over the course of a couple of months, I guess, the conversations continued between Tom and I and Jared and I. And then Jared said, hey, would you be interested in going to Belize? And I was just like, let's do it. So we did it.
Wow.
And it was amazing. It was amazing. It felt very, it was very surreal, you know, uncovering something like that felt so ancient and spiritual, you know, and especially the location where it was uncovered, where we uncovered the pyramid at the top of it. You could look out and just, you could see everything. I mean, just for, I don't know, you could see for days.
Wow.
So that was an interesting, to me, that was an interesting thing that they picked that spot. It felt intentional.
And you know, especially when it comes to LIDAR data, there is a mass movement in using that to uncover temple complexes, to uncover things that are hidden under vegetative growth for decades, right, for generations, that kind of stuff. I mean, even here recently, there was literally the article out of BBC talking about a PhD student that found an entire complex by accident, just looking over data and was like, oh, wow. Look at this, like an entire temple complex in Mexico that was totally undiscovered.
It's crazy.
And it's wild. There was the case of the kid in Canada, like a high school student that used satellite LIDAR mapping and everything to uncover a temple complex. He was like 16 years old, discovered it from satellite imagery.
That's amazing.
And just to know the realm of technology that is out there now, the precision that is out there with LIDAR mapping, it's remarkable.
Absolutely remarkable. LIDAR itself is just absolutely remarkable. And I think that it's going to continue. I think that industry is going to continue to grow and the technology is going to continue to sharpen, and we're going to start seeing some really amazing discoveries because of that technology.
Now, let's start off at the beginning of a LIDAR session. How do you begin that? How do you begin to target specific areas, Christy?
So the way LIDAR works, with aerial LIDAR, which is what we do, we have sensors that sit in the bottom of the planes. And these, which we walk, this was walking LIDAR, what we did in Belize. We walked this LIDAR,
oh, but wow.
It's the same concept is the same. It shoots lasers down at the earth, and then it measures the time it takes to get back up to the sensor. And then you build a topographical map of the earth, and you're able to see different anomalies and things that, you know, maybe when you're looking at the earth, like these, like you said, the 16-year-old kid in Canada, you know, and he's looking at this and he sees these anomalies, kind of like the Nazca lines in Peru, you know, when you fly over, obviously that's not natural, you know? And so to see these discoveries and these anomalies from the air, I think we're going to continue to find more and more and uncover more and more about our human history using these technologies and ground radar. You know, there's ground penetrating radar now, and mm-hmm. so there continues to be this just new development and these amazing technologies that can penetrate the earth, that can penetrate the water. You know, now we've got bathymetric LIDAR that can, you know, penetrate water, which is new, relatively new. So it's going to be interesting to see what we find in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Because once again, like we typically talk about whenever we have Jared Murphy on, is it does not take long for us to forget things. It doesn't take long to forget who built something. We put plaques on it nowadays, you know, like, this building brought to you by Texaco, you know, things like that. But it wasn't always that way. You know, it was just the fact of, well, you lived in a localized area and that was the temple that you went to. You didn't need it to say Zeus on the top of it. Everybody knew what the heck that temple was for. You know, and that's just it. Once that localized aspect disappears, even with the local population, Jared, was it the fact that they fully knew about what was there at this complex? Did they know that this complex existed or anything like that?
Well, it's interesting. It was explored over the last 75 years a few times.
Okay.
Belize was a British, colony. And we're really just a part of Guatemala. I'm not saying that Belize is Guatemala, and it's just that in the world of the Mayan Empire, this would have been smack dab central Mayan. It would have, because you're on one coast, and it's the narrowing on the continent. So you know, there's no Panama Canal, but there is, however, a number. It's interesting from where the private land we worked and where the ruins are. There are river systems that would allow you to get pretty far into the country for you to go from the coast to get over to the Pacific Ocean through Guatemala. And in the Mayan world, it just didn't stop. And for the local villagers currently, they suspect, you know, there's always there's a few hundred acres. But like Christy said at the beginning, when you're up there for the first time and you're looking around and you're seeing for miles or days.
Yeah.
They already know from being sustainable farmers. We can stand up there with the locals and they can point and say, well, so-and-so is farming over there. And you're looking at basically it looks like a short mountain. And in reality, they're like, you know, we're pretty sure that's a pyramid and that's a pyramid. And they're pointing to where they already know. And it's likely because they're finding artifacts. And the reason, by the way, that villagers are farming on hills is because it's where all the composted soils from all the leaves that have dropped. I mean, it's tropical, but they have the foliage changes over the seasons. Their rainy season is winter. And so, they have this accumulation of some of the richest growing soil that they're working with is composted on the sides of the ruins of massive pyramid complexes, which are, as we're finding, like you said, from the LIDAR scans that are coming up from Mexico to everywhere that, hey, it's not a couple million people. It's maybe tens of millions of people that lived in this environment, and the complexes that are coming up are showing that. And it'll be interesting to see. But yeah, they can tell you, oh, that's a pyramid, or that's a buried structure. They sort of know. So although the site officially is a couple hundred acres, yeah, it's hundreds, it may be thousands. It could be more like a county than a city.
Wow. And that is massive to come across, and a massive undertaking to even begin the excavation of part of that, even to begin the excavation of one temple is huge. The prime example I would give would be Chachobin. I just went to the Chachobin ruins while I was on a cruise all of a couple weeks ago, and that is one of the most modern temples to be uncovered there in the area, to be touristed, and that was discovered in 1994. Just opened a few years ago. They'd excavated it to the point where it could be, you know, shown to the public, things like that, have trails put around it, everything else. But a lot of the complex is still under excavation, things like that. But just to give you a time frame of how long it takes from discovery to, hey, we've got a tourist center. You know,
but to me, I don't know. And maybe it's our age, 1994. I'm sure to younger generations, that seems like a really long time ago.
That's a blink.
To me, yeah. When you say 1994, it seems relatively recent.
It is. It's
for
very,
these discoveries. Yes. I mean, for these discoveries, like it seems, you know, when we were in Belize, we were able to go to a cave system, which was really amazing.
Yep.
And Jared, wasn't it? It was like 1997, I think, when they discovered that cave system.
Yeah. Yep.
And wow. Yeah. And it was just this amazing cave system that it felt otherworldly. I don't know if we've got pictures. That looks like, yeah, there we go. Oh, gosh.
I said Lara Croft.
Yeah, well.
But yeah, so, that is.
Yeah, so it was that, but that wasn't discovered until 97. And that, to me, was wild that it hadn't been discovered, because that's relatively recent.
And yeah. even the local indigenous population did not know of the cave system or anything like that?
No, and they farm near it. And they farm near it. They're literally, we're climbing up a mountainside. They said it's a 45-minute walk. It was 2.5 miles through.
Wow.
It was a 45-minute walk for them.
It's a 45-minute, yeah, yeah. For somebody that's used to the terrain or in a casual stroll in a public park in the city.
You know, to be fair, Christy, now that I think about it, none of them carry watches. So what's 45 minutes or 2 hours? They don't care.
You know what? You're right. That's a good point. They don't have clocks around either.
So. Everything they do in a day, maybe it felt like only 45 minutes of their time, when in reality it was also an hour and a half. But they don't care. But Chris, this is like the cave that we're describing. Yeah. It's like a cathedral. But not just one cathedral with one big dome area. It's like a hollowed out mountain out of something from Lord of the Rings.
Well, and specifically to the Mayan people, like the cave systems, cenotes, things like that are sacred areas. So that's why I was curious that they had no idea that it was there.
Oh, the Mayans did, because they found a giant Mayan pot in it. I mean, I'm talking like one you could put your arms around and hug. And so the Mayans knew, but the local villagers didn't know, and no one bothered to crawl in there and figure it out.
Gotcha.
And instead, it's this massive hollowed out mountain that has multiple rooms. Each room, one of them looks like a stadium seat theater that can maybe seat hundreds or thousands.
The ceiling height in the tallest room was, 80 feet?
Wow. Yeah.
And the short rooms were not like 20 feet. All of them were 30, 50 feet. And so you'd get to so to give you an idea about rooms, so for everyone listening, it's you kind of sort of crawl or scoot into the first room, which is about 15 feet. But when you're in that room, you could describe it more like the size of a warehouse. Mm. And then you have to either step up or step through an area, which is more like a doorway to the next room, which then opens up and is even bigger. And then you go into the next room. And again, the rooms are more like warehouse size. And at some points to get to, this is not a casual touristy spot. Intermediate to advanced, you do have to balance on the top of stalagmites that you use as steps. And if you slip, you're going to fall 15, 20 feet. Wow. And you have to step on them and they just kind of skimper around and they're like, we'll show you the next room. No big deal. And
so you're just holding on for dear life.
Yeah.
This is not praying you don't slip.
Yeah, this is not a safe, like that picture you have up. It's a great picture, but it doesn't show you the depth. Right now, Christy, myself, our friend and camera and film cinematographer, Ian has, we all have lights pointing to try to get it on film.
Yeah.
We're all in just our headlamp. Anything we can light up, we're doing to try to get you that picture. But the scale is entire. That's Ian right there and Ian Fisher. And you cannot describe the scale in the photography. So it's a little frustrating, but it is as magical as, you know, just think Lord of the Rings, you're actually there.
Yeah.
It felt like we had stepped into another planet, like we were in another realm or something. Yeah. We weren't even on Earth anymore, or we were in some other dimension. It just felt otherworldly. It was amazing.
And such an incredible experience to be able to explore something like that, that once again had been pretty well untouched for such a long time, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It really was. That was our, by the way, we decided to do that our first day on the expedition. So we hike in, and mind you, again, this is not 2.5 miles down a street or an uphill road. This is up and down trails that are in a mountain system. So we're not just traveling down a trail. We're traveling down to creek beds. We're traveling up from creek beds. We're traveling through a horse trail that's there's subsistence farmers that are basically by hand planting and harvesting about an acre and a half, 2 acres total per farmer. These are people who are tending their fields daily. They have no machinery. They have nothing. Some or a few have horses, but we're walking up and down and then ascending up the side of a mountain. And then eventually we're getting to a point where we're going up a pitch that you didn't need a rope, but it was not something you would have wanted to fall down. So up 200 feet to the mouth of a cave, which you think, oh, that cave, this is cool. And you have no idea what you're in for.
Wow.
I don't know, Christy, you have any more thoughts on the approach?
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty good way to describe, you know, it sounded like a near-death experience. So it's pretty much what it was.
See, coming in for the dramatic kill. Yeah.
He was right. That last ascent, that last 200 feet I do remember standing at the bottom looking up thinking, damn, that's, we're going to scale that.
You know, we went through it, Chris. So the inside's magical and it's as really, we're not overselling this, but there's another side. When you come out the other side, it's actually the cave system continues, but part of it collapsed. I don't even know if they know how far under the mountain system the cave system goes, but the next section collapsed. They weren't going to bring us into it. I'm sure some professional splunkers should take a look at it. And again, this is not an intermediate or easy. You can't just go here as a tourist. This is, you really need to be in a certain physical condition to be able to get in and out of this cave system. But on the far side of it, let me tell you about standing in the middle of a killer bee mound.
I forgot about that.
We live a life, people, where ArchaeoX, like Christy and I, can forget standing in killer beehives because there's too much going on.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's a great, I'm going to use that soundbite later, Chris, if you can cut it out.
Oh, absolutely.
I forgot you died. I forgot you stood in the killer bee mound. I forget all the dangerous, dumb shit you do. So, yeah, this, we're trying to do a photograph, And so Ian and Christy and our guide are standing up above still, because we're just coming up. We're in the mouth of a cave entrance that's 100 feet tall. And we thought maybe we could do the scale of it if I would climb down and stand on what looked like a black mound of dirt. Well, the killer bees, they burrow in the ground.
Yeah.
So the black mound, I'm standing there looking up and realized, oh, shit. Because I know what, ground bees look like here in Minnesota. I know what the hives, you just know when you're, I've unfortunately been around some of them. But yeah, no, I realized I was standing in the middle of a massive, we're talking 8 diameter killer bee mound.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was day one.
What an experience.
We scrambled out the end, the mouth of that. When we got to the end, we scrambled quickly out.
Well,
we'd leave.
And that's just it. When you're out in the midst of all of that, there's very little you can do to escape those kinds of circumstances. We stumbled across a killer bee mound. Like, you're walking through the jungle. You may well stumble across a killer bee mound,
Yeah.
You were saying pre-show, Christy, there's jaguars and stuff in the trees. Like, that is a real thing.
Everybody was giving me a hard time about carrying a knife every day. And I was just like, there are giant cats in the trees.
Yeah.
And we can't see them, but they can see us.
Yeah.
Well, there's crazy monkeys. Don't forget about the crazy monkeys.
Yeah.
There's crazy monkeys. Yeah.
And, let's start getting into the excavation of the pyramid and the temple complex real quick, Jared. How did you all go about beginning that with the local people?
You know, first it's meetings with the mayor, lots and lots of me, a lot of time on WhatsApp, communicating directly with the mayor about how do we go about it, who's all going to be involved, how many people, how many days. So getting out the logistics, basically, of what are we going to do every day, where, if we're going to start.
Yeah.
So for those that do the yard cleanup in fall, this is similar, except it's just on a 270-foot mound that has 8 basically pyramid buildings on it that are all covered, and there are trees, and there is a lot of invasive brush and trees that have twisted up and broken up the ruins. And the goal first is, okay, so how do we clear acres of trees and brush, or how do we make it more accessible? Where do you stage everything? I mean, the logistics of planning this actually was it seemed really natural. Everybody shows up and they're like, well, yeah, we're going to cut a bunch of stuff down and go put it in a pile. It wasn't that simple. 2 days I arranged so that 2 days prior to when we go to the where we're going to clear the stuff off the mounds, well, they had to clear a space below where they could stack everything. How could they get everything out of the area of where they're going to work? The logistics of working with 140 people, who's coming what day, who's running those people. It's a massive undertaking.
Yep.
It's for those that like logistics, it's exciting.
And I don't want to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Also, just to add to the excitement is when they're, we had a little bit of a conflict. I think there was a little bit of a power struggle in the village, and so that was an interesting thing to deal with as well. We had our project manager left and went and did another job, and somebody else took over, and it was just a whole, it was kind of an ordeal.
Yeah, because you end up with the localized of like, well, I don't like working with that guy. I've worked with that guy before.
There were some trust issues within the village, and which is just natural.
Yeah,
just to navigate these things. But I do feel like that it was navigated well.
Well,
I feel like that the issues were navigated well.
And this goes to speak a lot to the cultural significance of digs like this. What has been the local reception, not just by the government, because of course the government has, fantastic plans of tourism and all kinds of things, Jared, but what has been the local village aspect? How have they received the uncovering of these locations? You know,
I got feedback within a week of us leaving that said that they had tourists arrive at the site and they took them up to where we had worked. It helped them make really well every dollar at this village is needed, and it helped them bring more tourists out immediately.
That's
and
great.
We're able because otherwise, you know, the site is not technically open to the public. You just have to stumble on it, and this really helped them.
That's fantastic to be able to provide that for them, to be able to have that as an option for them. Because once again, it's not like it's on the tourist map, so to speak. It's not like you can, you know, go take a tour and buy tickets from the Ministry of Tourism. But if you're there and you're in the local village, they'll gladly, for a few bucks, take you up there, show it to you, things like that.
Yeah.
And yes, it makes it much more accessible.
They have a parking lot. The site used to be open.
Awesome.
It's just a massive site that requires a lot of maintenance and upkeep, and they have to do it all volunteer. If it wasn't for ArchaeoX and for us doing what we were doing, all their current activity on the site, because it's so big, it's hundreds of acres.
Yeah.
Again, it's multiple 270 foot, give or take, mounds with multiple buildings on them, and then there's still stuff below. This again is not just about pyramids. It's clearly a Mayan community. It would have been either a town or a district, but it's not all remotely understood or uncovered. It's been it's there. It'd be really, really, really interesting if we can continue our next phase and well, not just uncover what's on top, but look at the maybe get a really good snapshot of the suburban life of the Mayan world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, are there specifically any locations that y'all have found, like, let's say, like trash heaps, things like that? Anything that, you know, would specifically be useful in that regard, Jared?
So our first expedition, which Chris, everyone was going to go on, and there are mitten mounds, and for those that don't know,
I blame the government and the passport office.
Yeah, the yeah, Christy, actually, Chris, you should tell Christy how you did not come.
It was waiting on my passport, literally. If you're looking for a passport, folks, good God, give them a good many months to get it to you. I paid for expedited shipping, everything else. It came like a couple weeks after the expedition left. And it was supposed to be here about like a week or so before. So, yeah.
So mine, actually, my passport expired the day before I was set to go to Belize.
Oh, God.
And I only had a month. Like when Jared asked if I wanted to go, I had a month. So I did the expedited thing too. And I had my passport. I had a new passport within a week. It was like a week and a half.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wait, where were we right before we went off on your passport?
We were talking about the future of things, what we're looking at coming up, that kind of stuff.
Well, hopefully you're going to have your hand in that a bit, but for those listening, I speak with the mayor frequently, about every other day, and there's always meetings. There's been elections. There's actually a meeting about the ruins in the next day, and there's always something going on, but I'm in constant contact to not only facilitate us coming back, but to coordinate with the village. If we come back, we're looking for 30 or 40 days. We're looking at working with more like 30 villagers, not you know, we work with 140 people over 10 days. If we come back and work for basically like 40 days, 34 of it would be work. And out of 34 days and 30 people, we're basically looking at shifts of almost 1,000. Basically, they don't have 1,000 people, but it would be about 1,000 shifts of work over 35 days to continue to clear and clean so we can get the first phase of this work to uncover these pyramids and discover what's there and do all the technological work, hopefully more LIDAR and ground penetrating radar.
Well, and you know, like you were saying, you have found refuse piles, things like that from previous inhabitant. So being able to sift that, sort that, you could find out quite a bit about the culture that lived there, quite a bit about what the localized food was, things like that.
Yeah, the shells, the mitten mounds, for everyone that don't know, they're an ocean-sided society. The pyramids were covered in a plaster that was made from a shell material, which, by the way, some of that plaster is still exposed at the site in some of the stones that were even in the video that we just watched at the beginning. These are these mitten mounds are thousands of tons, not thousands of pounds, thousands of tons of these crushed shells that they would bake and they would cook, they would eat, but they would also use the shells for the plaster. But these mounds, and there's so many of them, and I really think it'll be interesting to maybe calculate how many people, but these mounds are 10, they're not like 10 or 15, they're like 25, 35, 40 feet thick.
Wow.
And yeah, and these are crushed tiny little shells, and then over, I don't know, maybe periods of time over hundreds. This is over, okay, maybe not initially. For the initial cultures that were building the mounds, they were just trash heaps. But, and yeah, they contain pottery. But for some generations, within the thousands of years that, because the ruins we're at are at least 2,000 years. However, when we went back this last expedition, there's some speculation that they could be 5,000 years. And so the for those that haven't heard of the Mayan culture being that old, they're starting to push back the dates, which is great, because they're starting to push back the Egyptian dates and Göbekli Tepe and everything else. Yeah. So that we're looking at basically a group of people using the mitten mounds as just a trash heap. Then there were some generations that were using it as burials and also to hide valuables. So when we were on our first expedition, what came out of that first areas look like from these mitten mounds, which are these shell trash heaps, were Olmec, Toltec, and possibly Mayan statues.
Oh, crystal. Wow.
Yeah. And these are things that today are worth, for those wondering, some of them are worth hundreds of thousands, some are worth tens of thousands, some are worth a million.
Yeah.
And so the trash mounds, the mitten mounds, do possibly have incredibly historically significant relics and really culturally significant for us to be able to understand and unpack their history. So getting into the mitten mounds, getting into the trash heaps are really, really significant to us also.
Yeah.
And I've been talking with our prior expedition's landowner and some people that are interested in the property. I've been looking at going back to that area also to do more mapping and to do more work. And I guess, you know, Christy and I were there, and it was suggested that if we wanted to take a 2-day hike into the jungle, we could go to some ruins that no one's been to, other than the locals. When you talk about the locals, all the local farmers do know of just about anywhere that they could possibly put a farm. Believe it or not, they'll walk through the jungle,
yeah,
a quarter mile to get to the acre that they farm. And there are areas where they're very well aware of ruins that, you know, the rest of us aren't. So yeah.
when we were at Nimue Putin, I think it was, there was a groundskeeper that we spoke with, and he said that he kind of pointed off in the distance, and he said the same thing. He said basically everywhere within, you know, like everywhere you can see, like there's ruins everywhere. Wow. And they're temples and things that the villagers know, and they go and they pray and do what they do. And so they'll go, he said his uncle, there's a temple out there somewhere in the middle of the jungle, and he goes and he spends 2 days, 3 days, 4 days maybe, he said, every year, just praying and, you know, culturally whatever he does.
Yeah.
So, it's an interesting country, and it's obvious that the Mayan presence was it was highly populated for sure.
Yeah. And you know, with the thought of what's up next, what have we found, things like that, Christy, especially when it comes to the LIDAR, where is it leading you guys? What are some of the upcoming targets that y'all are looking at? Things like that. If that's something y'all can share.
Are you waiting on me, Christy?
Yeah, you can take this one.
Okay. So, well, we're looking at going to Peru. And in order for us to, so a lot of planning is involved. And as fast as it seems to have moved from the first expedition to the second expedition, which was really my third trip to Belize, getting into doing LIDAR requires us, like, for instance, when we met Christy originally, when Tom Elmore pulled in Christy, we were looking at doing, let's scan the known, the ruin area that is sort of known. And then, like I said, the farmers kind of know in the distance, like, that mound is a pyramid or not. But Christy's original suggestion to us when we were looking at, hey, should we scan this or not? Our initial scans we thought would just be a few hundred acres, and in which case they're like, well, no, we have a plane, we can just do 4,000.
Wow.
So yeah, to give you an idea then, the scale by which we would be able to then take it from satellite imaging or ground walking LIDAR to an aerial scan, that would be 4,000 acres. And for those wondering, 600 acres makes a section, a few sections make a town or a county. And so 4,000 acres would be a great snapshot of the area. And so it's not so much as putting a needle on a map or to think just a few hundred feet. We have the opportunity to scan a larger area, but part of that has to go with now the practical science of the logistics of how we are actually going to uncover where we are. And if this is ground zero, how do we move out from ground zero in an efficient way? Because basically just bury a whole town or city and figure out how are you going to efficiently collect data from the accumulation of the abandonment to intrusive burials to grave robbing. And how do you account for a chronological look at the erosion or the accumulation and the composting? And then how do you get down to the original layer, and where do you put all the extra stuff? And is any of the ground you're removing usable soil for farming? How do you deal with the humanitarian and the existing life, day-to-day life of subsistence farmers? And so the logistics of how far out do we go with the LIDAR? Only not that it's not fun to, we want to who doesn't like to discover things? It's addictive, like popping bubble wrap, right?
Oh, Christy? Yeah. each bubble's a new discovery.
Right. And it's like, with just one more acre. And it's like, we don't need to dig it up. We just need to know it's there. I always want to dream and imagine and look ahead and discover it at the same time. It's like, okay, how do we put down practical, logistical work to uncover and do it efficiently, not do it in 100 years, not do it in 50 years, not do it in 20 years, not do it from 1995. How can we efficiently look at collecting more volumes of data that have never been collected before in a time that would allow students, teachers, and researchers themselves to look at the data and come up with better answers about our past?
Go ahead.
And that's another aspect of ArchaeoX, is the educational part of it and pulling LIDAR into that. One of the great things about the condition of Belize right now is when you do LIDAR, we like to call, there's like a leaf on, leaf off in seasons, because LIDAR doesn't penetrate vegetation very well. And so when there's a lot of dense vegetation, it's hard to see through it. And so that's why a lot of jungle discoveries are made using drone LIDAR. Not really aerial fixed wing planes, which is what we fly. But right now, because of the condition of the country, it's been on fire for 2 months. I don't know, a month. They've been dealing with a lot of fires. Yep. And it's burned into the village and it's burned some of the ruins through some of that, area. And so right now would actually be an ideal time to go down there and fly LIDAR. And just like Jared was saying, you know, the cost to get down there is the cost of the, you know, a project, basically. Yeah. Whether flying 200 acres or 2,000 acres, it doesn't, that's not going to make a big difference in price for us. You know what I mean?
So yeah, yeah.
The expense of it is just to get down there. But right now would be a great time to get down there and fly a LIDAR since it's burned. You know, yeah. We would have an opportunity to maybe uncover some things that we wouldn't see had that not happened.
A tragically fortunate opportunity.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, Christy, you should explain what just burned.
What just burned?
Yeah, well, people don't know. You just said it because it burnt. And Chris just mentioned tragically, but the reality is I don't think anyone listening would understand unless you...
So they just set fires. They're burning. They burn, I guess, for crops, you know, to get ready for farming. Yeah. Or it's really dry.
Yeah,
right,
controlled burn there. to get rid of old vegetation and things like that.
But there is no control. Like, they don't control anything.
No.
So the fires just get out of control, yeah. And it burnt, like, I don't know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres.
Wow.
Yeah. Right after we were there, they had stacked. So they cut out efficiently, 140 people cut out a lot of brush, a lot of grass, a lot of razor grass. And they stacked it all at the bottom of the mound that we worked on. A few days after we left, there were fires burning that they were clearing, like Christy said, for planting. However, it was at the dry season. It was not the wet season, which meant that the fires went out of control. Most of southern Belize burned out of control. It killed, in this particular village and the village next door, it killed horses, wow. Other farm animals. Yeah. It burned houses. And before we left, we drove by. They were doing a controlled burn, and they burnt down an electrical pole and killed electricity for one whole village for a while. And while we were there, by the time we had come back, we had heard within a week that a number of the subsistence farmers that we were showing us around their village lost their crops. These are crops that they need in order to have food all year. They do not go to the store. They don't buy things from a grocery like we do. They grow their food for the year, and they only plant two crops. And so this is the last crop before the rainy season, and they, quite a few of them, lost a lot of the food they needed for their families. And then, of course, they lost farm animals, and it's incredible. But everything they cut down that was a part of our work with 140 people, 140 people can do a lot of damage to a lot of brush. And not one bit of it was left. The fires made it all the way to the ruins and burnt everything they cut down.
Wow.
All of it was gone. Nothing but ashes, which isn't truly incredible. But ironically, because everything was cut down, the fire didn't continue up the mound.
Yeah.
Would have been helpful. But, you know, not for carbon dating, but it would have been really helpful to see things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible that they were having a really rough time, and we brought humanitarian aid. Part of it's like, we want to do the discoveries and the exploration, but listening to the village, how can we provide other help besides immediate employment? How do we, like Christy mentioned, education. The point of our LIDAR and our scientific work is also providing with that educational material for kids here in the United States to learn in a more interesting, connective way with Mayans and ruins, but also the science behind LIDAR can be different applications for what we're doing down there. But humanitarian wise, we can't just go down there and not listen to what the village needs. So we brought some clean filtered water.
Oh, absolutely.
Filter stuff, but it's really hard to work with people where you know them all, and then their village is deeply affected by fire immediately. To the point. Yeah.
But they're such a resilient, they're such a resilient culture. You know, they're used to, I guess, stuff like this, and they just bounce back in ways that are truly amazing. And they have, you know, their shelter building down to an art. You know, I think they said they take, how many did they say, Jared? 24 men out in the woods, or 12 men or something, and they cut 24 to make their thatch roofs. Like, they had the numbers of
Yeah, it's a 30 or 40, but it's over 400 palm leaves.
Wow.
Uh-oh.
Jared froze up.
Oh, no.
Well, but, you know, as somebody who has worked in the world of education, Christy, it is...
Which they're entirely waterproof.
They are entirely waterproof. You froze up there for a second, my friend. Sorry. We heard thatch roofs and then entirely waterproof. So I think we got the gist, but...
Yeah. And the sun's coming. I'm darkening out. I'm just... So much for my studio time here.
But you know, when it comes to education, this is something that I spoke about on the remote viewing crew, something that I've spoken about at numerous conferences, the idea of how do we bring this to the next generation? How do we make the next generation excited about not only this kind of archaeological work, this kind of technical work with drones and LIDAR, but excited about the humanitarian aid? How do we make the next generation there in Belize excited about rediscovering their past and uncovering temple complexes, uncovering these things so that they can be shared not only with the world, but with themselves, you know, and you rediscover know, and reclaim part of their past.
And I think it's good that you mentioned that, you know, it's kind of wild to think that they are interested in their history, but it's almost like high school kid, you know, like when I was in high school, or maybe probably when you were in high school, you know, and we were learning about history, you know, it was just kind of like,
yeah,
you just had to get through it, get through it, memorize the facts, take the test, get through it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's the mindset of the younger generation of the Belizean / Mayan culture there right now is, you know, technology starting to creep into the village. They don't have good signal, but there's a couple of hills on both sides of the town where they'll get service. And so you'll see like teenage kids, you know, up there with their cell phones and stuff. And so I don't know, that's a hard question to answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hard question to answer because it's like trying to get our kids, you know, over here interested in history. But, you know, obviously, one of the reasons why we're doing this is, you know, what they're being taught in the classroom is not, in fact, it doesn't look like that's really what happened, you know? And so now we're trying to figure out like why the history books told us one story growing up, but yet all the facts and all of these discoveries are telling us another story. And so we're just trying to kind of figure, you know, those things out. And so I think maybe getting kids interested in the field of you know, science and technology and LIDAR, I think that might be one hook.
It is, you know? It is a great hook.
You're right.
It's it a great is. Hook.
And it's only going to get more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just at a LIDAR conference in Alaska last week, and it is incredible to think of the technology moving forward. If you think about where we've come in the last 50 years, and then you think about where we're going to, and how fast everything has happened.
Let me see. It was the CES right after COVID. CES is the Consumer Electronics Show, in Vegas. And I covered it this last year for for Curious Realm. In the past, I'd covered it for my Talking Sound podcast, looking at new technologies, things like that. And one of the people that I remember, this was the year directly when the world rebooted from COVID. There was somebody that came in and had a 1 millimeter radar dish used for LIDAR, things like that. Like it, and the size of a postage stamp, you could have gotten 25 of them. And each one of these had a range of, I want to say it was like 100 yards, something like that. It was massive. Like, I was like, imagine being able to put those on the side of a pair of sunglasses, and now you can give, like, you know, a pair of Alexa glasses, and now you can give them to a blind person, and they can actively have, like, radar interference as they walk in real time, and something the size of their glasses. Like, this was a 1 millimeter chip. It was crazy.
Wow. What a great idea, though. What a useful tool.
It's one of those, like, it's phenomenal to think of the technology that's out there whenever you go out and you look at these things, and the way that it's being leveraged, and the way that all of these technologies really do cross-compat and move from one thing to another. Because, yeah, once again, they none of these were originally designed for the use that you are using them for. They were designed to, much like you used them for previously, Christy, to go out and, you know, look for leaks in oil lines without having to dig up the ground with heavy machinery, things like that. They were used for very common sense, awesome things, but now they're being used for amazing scientific uses, because somebody saw the potential and went, ooh, that'd be cool, instead of using a whole bunch of people to dig out the side of a mountain just to see if something's there, you know?
Yeah. What a time saver.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty phenomenal to see where that's going. And yes, that is one of the many ways. At the remote viewing conference, somebody asked me, like, because I talk a lot about how do we pass this on to the next generation? How do we pass this research on to the next generation? Because I'm coming up on 50. You know, most of the people that are involved in these research fields are older than me. So if they're looking at me to carry on the mantle, like, I'm on your coattails on the way out the door, bud. You know, like, we need 25-year-olds verved about this is what we need. We need people who are burgeoning in these technological fields to be excited about these potentials. And yes, the way that we get a 20-year-old interested in that is, turn it into a video game, give it rules, you know, things like that. Uh-huh. So when you give them something that they're very familiar with, a joystick, a screen, using a drone is a great way to get them excited about archaeology, and using those kind of tools and seeing it in real time, you know, it's awesome. And it's great when you can snatch a kid's brain at about 8-9 years old and get them excited about that. So the fact that you guys are working in the world of not only getting students here in America excited about this stuff, but the local students there excited about refinding their cultural root, refinding the technology that was lost from their previous civilization, and the cities and the places lost by their previous civilization. That's fantastic. It's awesome that you guys are fully involved in that.
It's an awesome thing. Thanks. I can't wait to see what happens.
Well, speaking about what happens next, I know you guys have tons of plans. There's a podcast coming, all kinds of things. Let's get into that. We have you for about another 5 minutes or so. So let's get into some of what's coming from ArchaeoX, Jared.
Yeah. Well, Christy and I will be doing a show on Archaeo. It's just exactly what it sounds like. Well, actually what it sounds like, ArchaeoX.com. And we'll be live streaming, and we will be doing pre-recorded shows. That'll be on the website. Of course, it'll be on streaming services and podcast catchers, but come to the website. You'll see our humanitarian and some of our exploration work, ArchaeoX.com. And of course, we'll be doing live events. And then Michael Roser from Dark Hour Paranormal, Michigan UFO sightings, are also our partners, and they will be doing their own show, and we'll be doing a collective work on ArchaeoX.com. We really want that support there. Podcast catchers, of course. But you will hear from us. You'll see our schedule up and coming there. And like I said, upcoming soon, we have 3 hours with Michael Cremo that will be cut up. And
awesome.
And you hear soon. And then hopefully Christy and I will be talking to Michael Cremo again here soon within a week. And, you know, there'll be more of that and Dennis Stone coming up, and there'll be all sorts of fun new stuff. And so there'll be the interviews with the people that are already doing the work or have sites around the country and the world. And then there'll be the general fun conversations that all of you enjoy. We'll be doing it all.
Absolutely, man. It is so exciting to see all of these things coming to fruition. We've talked about them in background for so long, and to see them happening for you is truly, truly exciting, man. It's awesome to see the progress that you have made already, and I cannot wait to see where you take it from here. So let everybody know where they can go to donate, where they can go to get involved, where they can go to help spread the word of ArchaeoX, Jared.
Well, you know, ArchaeoX.com. We'll give you some more instructions. We don't have a way to donate at all yet. We will have, you know, my new book will be coming out.
Yep.
There will be other products, and there'll be a store, so definitely support us there. And for now, notaliens.com or Not Aliens on YouTube, Dark Hour Paranormal, Michigan UFO Sightings. There'll be different ways that we'll be letting everybody know that ArchaeoX is live. You'll
Oh, we're losing
YouTube, no. Instagram, and all of it.
Well,
that was Christy's idea.
Well, awesome. Jared, thank you so much as always. Christy, it has been more than a pleasure meeting you. Hold the line, guys, real quick while I close things out with the audience for this segment. All that kind of great stuff. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to many more updates from ArchaeoX with this. I cannot wait to see where this expedition goes, Jared.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, I'm hoping you'll be involved, Chris, and we'll have more to tell everyone and your listeners.
Absolutely. Well, while you are online checking out everything from ArchaeoX, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the video channels from our guests at curiousrealm.com/videos. Their YouTube channels are embedded right there for easy following and liking and subscribing. So while you are online, also make sure to stop on by Curious Research. Curious Research is our new endeavor to help the world of UAP studies, cryptozoological studies, and parapsychology prepare themselves to shake hands with science. So stop on by, get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log today to help support Curious Research and Curious Realm. Stay tuned through this commercial break, everybody. When we come back, we'll be joined by our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News talking about the recent kerfuffle with Lou Elizondo and some very unvetted photographs in his touring presentation that he has had. We will be getting into that and what the impact of such things mean to the UFO UAP community and disclosure at large. We'll be talking about that right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying around, and thank you so much to our sponsors, True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is your source for amazing CBD products made through a spigyric process. They use every part of the plant, combust it down, reuse it, and reuse it until there is nothing left but amazing CBD product using a full spectrum source. It's fantastic. It is amazing stuff. Stop on by, check them out, folks. I have used True Hemp Science for at least the last 7 years of my life, and they are awesome. Actual terpene profiles. It's fantastic stuff. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you can go to. Curious7 is the code that you can use to get 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more, and two free 50 milligram edibles as well. Our guest in this segment is Mike Turber. We will be talking about the latest news and kerfuffle in the UFO UAP community. The UFO mothership, as revealed by Lou Elizondo in his latest presentation, which, sorry folks, but apparently there are some locations that, Lou has not been appearing at, and people are trying to get refunds, things like that, from what I understand. And a lot of it is because possibly, as I have up from futurism.com right now, and they're the bite section, Pentagon whistleblower admits photo of UFO mothership was fake. So that is the topic for tonight, is Lou Elizondo. Here is a picture of his, the picture that he actively used, which was supposedly caught outside the Romanian embassy. And I'm here to tell you, as an AV operator, as somebody who spends tons of time in ballrooms, it's very easy to look out the window of a ballroom. And I'm about to bring it up, folks. Here is the actual image of the ballroom in the U.S. Embassy. So yeah, take a look at that. Take a look at the image on screen. Yeah, there's some darkened parts, things like that, but pretty much the same thing. Even if it's a new installation, stuff like that, that is pretty well a ballroom chandelier being reflected on glass toward the outside, as somebody who sees that on a regular basis. So the topic of tonight with our good friend Mike Turber is security professionals, people who move from the world of security into disclosure, which I do not doubt that Lou Elizondo has had the best of intentions in what he has done. By the way, Mike, your microphone is open just in case you wanted to start muttering anything. I just wanted you to know.
Oh, yeah. I'm letting you run with it.
I don't want you to talk any smack and think that your microphone's mute and us have an unmute moment. But it's one of those, you know, much like we said, in our episode with Kathleen Martin and with Earl Grey about the statements from Stephen Greer. Even Kathleen Martin was like, I respect the work of Dr. Stephen Greer. She was like, I do not believe that he believes this. I believe that he has been fed this information, this quote, misinformation by bad actors. And I mean, who he trusts, who are vetted to him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I can see that. I can definitely see where someone, and hey, everybody.
Oh yeah, welcome to the show,
someone
Mike.
Would come in and, oh, thanks, appreciate that. There are times where people are given information, and for one reason or another, that information, whether it's disinformation or just bad information, that person runs with it, and then they run too far with the ball. They think they're making a touchdown, and they may be running the wrong direction. And in this case, what happened to Lou here, whether or not. The bigger problem is this. He is top dog. He's supposedly top dog in the UFO ufology community, so to speak. And even though remember in the beginning, he claimed he's not a ufologist and he's this and that, whatever, but he claims he's not. But obviously he's put there by everyone, and myself included. as a person that we have to look to for, you know, some sort of direction in what we're doing. Since 2017, December 16th, 2017, which is when all this really began, this second wave of right. UFO talk that was led by him, in TTSA. You know, you got Tom DeLonge, you got Hal Putoff, you got, Steve, and you got, Chris Mellon and so forth. So all of these people that, that pushed the disclosure / UFO talk forward. And so we look to these people with respect, and we have to assume that what they show us is vetted in such a way that they would hire someone like myself or a Mick West or whoever to go in and look at some of the evidence that they're going to present to make certain that what they present is, in fact, a real object that's in the sky that cannot be identified and not something where you have to fall flat on your face. Come to find out it ends up being a chandelier.
Yeah.
That's kind of a sad situation. So it makes you wonder, gee, if this is being reported as a mothership, and you can clearly see in the image, if you go down, you can see like there's a bush in the bottom right hand side that has like this glowing thing in front of it. Then if you look at the car in the parking lot, it's got like red on top of it. It's not in the U.S. Embassy is not even in that building. It's like on the other side of town. So however this image came about, and plus in the video that goes along with this image, he's in Philadelphia, I believe it is. And he's talking about the image, and he says that the pilots were talking about seeing this thing. Well, where the pilots are flying inside the building?
Yeah.
Where were these pilots? You know, and it's sad. It kind of is when you think about it. Here's a guy who maybe he believes that this image was what it was because that's what he was told, and he relied on someone to give him accurate information, and they did not. And so he's the front guy. He's the face. And so he has to go out there and report. It's, you know, it's just like a reporter reporting something. The reporter didn't make the news.
That's right.
You know, the reporter is only reporting what he's seeing, and he's being told what to say by the teleprompter or whatever. All of these things come into play. So you have to wonder Lou's going to have to speak up and say, hey, this image was given to us by blah, blah, blah. We were told this, we tried to look at it and whatever, but this image is so blatantly fake, or not fake, it's a real image, but the image is so blatant as to what it is that you have to question the very people that are being paid to look at these things and make certain that what they present is factual evidence. And it's unfortunate that in this case it was not. The same thing happened. You know, if you go back to the beginning, I don't mean to like belabor this, but if you go back to the very first image that they showed, I think you and I discussed this earlier, and Chris Mellon had a image when TTSA was announced. I think it's right after Tom DeLonge talked, and you had Lou come up, and Chris Mellon came up, and Chris Mellon was speaking about an image, and the image that was behind him at that conference. I don't know if you can put this up later whenever you do it in post, but the image that was behind him was actually a party balloon. If you just take the image and literally flip it upside down, you'll see it's a party balloon of the number one, and Chris Mellon was saying it was a UAP. So, you know, when you go from that to this and this into some things that we're, you know, I'll reveal in a documentary here soon, there's a lot of misidentification that should not be done in the way that it was. There's too many people out there that can vet these images and look at them and almost immediately tell you either what they are or with very little forensic work, you know, tell you what it is. I mean, digital forensics and video forensics, audio forensics is something I've been doing for a long time, and it's not that hard. And I would do it for free.
I will say that I do forensic audio recovery. I've done that for years. Uh-huh. I've done forensic photograph recovery for people where, like, you know, mom's photo album got caught in a flood. You know, we'd like to recover these pictures, stuff like that. I've done things like that for years. I've done video transfer, audio transfer, video editing and shooting video. The
3/4 of my life almost now has been spent in an industry doing that.
A lot of that has to do with fixing things. You're taking an image that may have been deteriorated, or part of the image is discolored, right, or not even there. So you have to extrapolate data to figure out what the image was of. And as you pull these images in, you start to get a discerning eye to where you can actually pick something apart relatively easy. For me, I'm colorblind, so it's actually in some ways easier for me because I'm not distracted by all this extra information that most people receive with good color vision.
Once again, the idea that I just spend tons of time in ballrooms with very large windows that overlook a downtown area. You know, like the exact image that you're looking at, where it's like, oh, look, there it is overlooking the Capitol, you know? Like that is straight up a ballroom image, and the image of a chandelier suspended in the air in a reflection. I can see that right off. But somebody who doesn't work there and do that.
Yeah, someone maybe should have warned him that before he goes on with it or whatever, that, hey, you know, it's like you practice these things before you actually go out and do these seminars and these talks and so forth. And you don't want to go out there with something you're going to purport as evidence without having it vetted in some way. There's a history of this. And keep in mind that many times Lou was being interviewed on different shows, and he would say that we have imagery of a, and then he would say, you know what an oil platform looks like, right? And of course everybody knows an oil platform. You know, we have imagery of a craft the size of an oil platform floating over a city. Really? So wouldn't a whole bunch of people have that image?
I mean, one would think
there should be.
Security cameras have that image.
On that road outside that building would have, I would have expected people to swerve off the road and stop going, holy crap, what is that in the sky?
Yeah.
I mean, how does it
land as far as him, and B, because we've definitely seen this before. The prime example that I give on the show all the time is GoFast. And you and I discussed GoFast long before it was eviscerated in the first NASA panel. When they were like, look, this is obviously a 40 foot weather balloon or other balloon type object caught in a draft going 40 miles an hour against a very zoomed in background that's very close to it. You know,
With the parallax effect making it look like it's going fast, and you know, and so you have GoFast, which is the three videos that they put out, all the data
was on screen. So once again, panel said, like, how did it make it to us? How did it make it to NASA's hands to look at this when all the information for the trigonometry of this is on the screen from the heads up display?
Right. And keep in mind, they had Eric Davis, which is one of their advisors, which supposedly was one of the ones that did the math on that image. And him and I got in a direct argument about this whole thing, and he kept saying my math was wrong. So I did an entire video just for Eric Davis to show him that the math that I did is correct, the math Mick West did is correct, and various other people that did the same thing is also correct. I think we all pretty much debunked it about the same time because the data was right there. We didn't have to go dig for it. You know, it wasn't a big mystery. But the problem is that once in the scientific community, which is what Tom DeLong promised TTSA was going to be, which is going to look at this from a scientific standpoint, the scientific community is well known for looking at something, and then once a better answer comes along using Occam's razor or whatever methodology, you move on to the either the most logical answer or the actual answer if you can come up with it. But in the case of GoFast, it's yet another case of someone in the same group of people, for some reason, the same group of people keeps purporting things as being something that they're not. And that's where you start looking at, okay, there's something else going on here, because you got Chris Mellon standing in front of an image that actually turns out to be a number one from a party, you know, like a birthday party balloon. And then you've got another image, or you have the video, the GoFast video, which is clearly debunked. The other two videos are summarily somewhat debunked, but not maybe to the level that people can accept. You have to like have the smoking gun on those. And then you have this situation where you have the same guy, Lou Elizondo, in all three cases, who on a television show pushed the GoFast video with two, and he hired two experts. One was a military pilot, and the other was a commercial aviation pilot. And both of them came in on that show and said that this, oh yeah, this is extremely fast. It's hauling ass, which is their technical term for how fast it was going. And the other one said it was 2/3 the speed of sound. Well, how in the world could they measure the GoFast going 2/3 the speed of sound when there's nothing showing how they came up with that number? Anyway, so, you know, you have that, and then you hit fast forward to now. But in between, remember, we had the UAP task force. They were given 144 different cases to look at and were able to solve apparently one. It's not a good track record. And again, you have one of the lead scientists on that panel was Travis Taylor, who is in that same core group. So.
Who
you still with me?
Yeah. I'm here, my man. Yeah. I didn't want to interrupt you as I had been. And
no problem. Yeah. We get
very carried away when we talk with you.
Yeah.
So because yeah. it's one of those that and I love the work of Travis Taylor. I've been looking to have him on for years. But you do have to wonder once again how these people even Hal Puthoff. I love Hal Puthoff. But even when I had breakfast with him and asked him to come on the show, he was at the IRVA conference a couple years ago, and I got to have breakfast with him. A really cool guy, very down to earth. And I asked him to come on the show, and he was like, "Unfortunately, I don't know what I'd actively be able to talk about." You know,
yeah.
And it was shortly after he was just read on to some new stuff, and you know that's. That's when it really pulled together for me, Mike, the fact that people like him who have been involved with so many different programs and read into so many different things that are coming up on their 50-year anniversary, you know?
Yeah. They've been around the block for a while.
The only way that you can have them not talk about that kind of stuff is to roll them into a new program that is adjunct in some way, shape, or form, you know?
Which is weird and somewhat hypocritical when you think about it. Now, think about the programs that Lou has been read into.
Yeah.
Okay. So think about the programs that David Grush has been read into, Ryan Graves, David Fravor, myself, you know, all kinds of people are read into programs. But after there's a certain point where, you know, like I can't talk about methods and tactics on how certain things are done or performed or how we gain certain knowledge or which instrument we use or how sensitive the instrument is, things like that. And that's understood. But that aside, if I'm outside and I'm looking at some other program, I can be ultra critical of that program, because if something's being reported outside of the military by someone who is originally in the military, who utilize a form, Defense Department form, it's the DD-1910 form, who utilize that form to declassify or to change the classification of three videos so that they could utilize them in a way that apparently they weren't utilized for. So keep in mind that 1910 form, that when Lou used that to get the three videos released, he basically it was agreed to that they could use the videos in the course of a non-government entity that was going to use the videos for a classification purpose of UAP to develop a program to classify unidentified aerial phenomenon. That's what that release was supposed to be. It was not for direct public release. And that was an early area of contention that we all had. But
yeah,
you know, that was then, this is now. I mean, someone, if I would think that if someone had done that, that there they would lose their security clearance and various other things. I'm not wishing that upon anyone, because God, you lose that, it's a pain in the butt. But at the same time, you start to see a pattern here of different things being said, and him going on TV shows and saying we may not be alone based on information that he acquired while he was in the military.
Yeah.
While he was in DOD. That in and of itself is a problem. That is a problem. And I don't see where he could have got Dobser to approve those statements, whether it be in his book or whether it just him talking. You have to wonder, you know, how did this get past those censors, so to speak? That we're here and it's been years now and nothing's really happened. So either A, the information he's putting out is so far off base from the original information that they don't really care, or B, the information is specifically given to him to put out so that people are let off track or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or C, it's accurate and we just have some sort of program that's not really catching it. So I don't know. It's one of the three, and you know, who knows which one.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, the idea of somebody like Lou, having been in these circles for years, Mike, I can appreciate I'm in a lot of circles. There's a lot of people that, and granted, I say it on the show all the time. I will give any experiencer their due until proven otherwise. I will always believe the experiencer until proven otherwise. It's one of those, when it comes to sources, when it comes to certain things, yes, there are people that I trust and I trust implicitly. And if somebody gave me something, I would vet it for certain, you know, and try to do more research and things like that. But I'm not going to say that I wouldn't make the same mistake, that I wouldn't just go with something from somebody that I've known for years. For instance.
Yeah, there's a scalability issue here. If you were about to go out and do a tour, and during your tour, you're going to be pushing this picture that you're going to make an outlandish claim is a mother. And we're not talking about just some obscure, you know, fuzzy image of a dot in the sky. We are talking about him stating that this is a mothership. He literally said, this is a mothership. Now, that's just a coined phrase for him or whatever, because how would he know it's a mothership? That could be the ship. It could, you know, Ford ship coming in is what I would think of. So you have this mothership coming in, and I think you and whoever would go around and do a series of talks around the country would have to, especially if you're insured. I mean, a lot of these talks where people go on, they have to have insurance. That way, if they say something that defames someone or if they whatever happens, they're covered by that. You know, just like when I did the documentary for the Las Vegas shooting, I mean, the whole reason why I was on that documentary was to help Ramsey, the director of the documentary, determine whether or not the stories he's being told were true or not. So we had Laura Loomer that was going to be on there. She was booted off because her stories weren't holding up, even though I worked with her. Jason Goodman of Crowdsource the Truth, his information was coming back, whatever. And John Cullen, you know, the theory of the helicopter shooting, blah, blah, blah. You know, all of these things had to be taken into account, and they all were canned from the final cut. And so that's what he should do as well. He should take it upon himself to take anything he's going to purport as being, you know, this type of evidence. We're not talking about someone going out and doing a regular seminar. We're talking about the number one question of all time, or maybe the number two question: are we alone?
Yeah.
And so he's putting out information that makes it seem like we may not be alone. So that's a pretty big deal. He's the top of the game. That image should have had ultra scrutiny, and anyone can look at this image and tell. And again, credit to John Greenwald for being, I think, the first one to put that out there. But holy hell, man, this is a big faux-pas. I mean, I don't want to laugh about it, but at the same time, you can't help but giggle a little bit and go, wow, this one slipped by, you know, so you can imagine how much other stuff are we being told that was, this or that that's probably not. Yeah. And that's unfortunate because there's too many great people in this community.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic people that want to believe, that do believe, and then they later find out that it's something like this, and that's sad.
And too many people doing good research, you know?
Absolutely.
I will come to the defense of when it comes to the even people like, you know, Travis, stuff like that. People give him a lot of flack for his work on Skinwalker Ranch. You know, just like, oh, launch another rocket. And it's like, hey, you know what's awesome? Repeatable science.
You know what's awesome? Was OSAP.
Yeah.
All of it started with OSAP. And so if you take everything back to the beginning, it was OSAP. And then they tried to cover up the fact that they were actually looking at ghosts and goblins and poltergeists and werewolves and dino beavers and stuff like that. But they scooped all that up and put it under the program, and they nicknamed it ATIP for the UAP aspect of it. So the ATIP never existed. There was no program ever called ATIP. So OSAP was the actual program. And so the coined nickname for what Lou was working on was the ATIP program. And that's why it had so many different names in the beginning. If you remember, it was Advanced Aerospace, Advanced Aerial, Advanced Aviation, blah, 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 you know, identification program. So, you know, these errors in the beginning start making people question, okay, well, what's going on? But it was verified that it was OSAP, started by Harry Reid and Robert Bigelow from Bass in Las Vegas. And when you think about it, Robert Bigelow at the time was the owner of Skinwalker Ranch. So all of this circles back. If you go all the way back, it goes back to the same people. You got Robert Bigelow, Harry Reid, $22 million fed into the OSAP program. At the time, Lukatsky was running the program. Lukatsky eventually was succeeded by Lou Elizondo, who ran the same program. But they couldn't have that program go throughout the Department of Defense under its normal auspicious name. So they coined that ATIP program. That's where you came up with the, you know, Advanced Aviation or Advanced Aerospace, you know, Identification Program. So you had ATIP, and then Lou effectively ran that. Of course, you had several things saying that he didn't, but he did. And then he advanced forward. So when he resigns on October 4th of 2017, and then next thing you know, on December 16th of 2017, which I was in the middle of the Las Vegas thing, he resigned 3 days after October 1st, which is the day of the shooting. So all of this stuff that came out right then made headlines all around the world. I mean, keep in mind that Leslie Keen and I'm brain farting on his name. When they did that article for the New York Times, they had already previously done the article for the Huff Post. But it didn't gain traction. So Ralph Blumenthal, brain fart on that one. So Ralph Blumenthal, Leslie King, they did the article, and guess who? When they did the article, and then they released it onto the New York Times with the three videos. That's when it gained traction. That's when everything changed. The face of ufology changed, and that's where we are from 2017 to today. We owe that to people like Lou Elizondo, Tom DeLonge, even though we've had some online arguments and stuff. But once the information that's being purported to you has been found to be probably not what they claimed it was, you have to stand up and you have to say, hey, we had these three videos that came out. We have to agree that the second video, or whatever number they want to call it, the GoFast video, it's probably not what we originally thought it was based on information that we have now. So we're going to remove that from the list. Did they ever do that? No.
Yeah.
Not once. And they've never done it with anything. And that to me is what separates the real investigation people, the people that are truly trying to look at this from a factual standpoint, from the ones that are just trying to gain some other advance out of it, whether it's money, fame, fortune, whatever. You have to question it. So that's where we're at now, and that's why Lou has been on the hot seat for a while.
Even if it's applying for additional grant money, things like that, there's for research, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Even going through the OSAP documents, it says specifically no R&D. So there was no research and development. They were analysts only.
And then the program was canned once the DIRDs came out. And they, you know, people started finding out that, hey, this program is studying werewolves, dinosaur beaver, like, so we call them dino beavers and stuff like this. They started to pull the plug. And then you look back and you say, well, Robert Bigelow was one of the biggest contributors to Harry Reid's campaign. And so, okay, so then he gets a $22 million contract to study all of these things. So where does he decide to study them at? Not at the locations that you and I would think of. You would go around the world to all these different UFO locations or whatever. Yeah. No, they decide to go to Skinwalker Ranch,
yeah,
a place he owned. And he bought that because of its thought to have all this paranormal activity and what have you. And so whether it does or doesn't have paranormal activity, I haven't been there specifically to look at it, but I can only assume that by the players that are there that it's probably hyped up a lot more than it actually probably has. You know, there's other people that went there, like Stephen Greenstreet of the New York Post. He went there. Yeah. Mick West went there, I believe. You know, so it just, after a while, you start getting frustrated. And there's a personal bias I have too. And truth be told, that Lou Elizondo was caught using a stock account on X, which, you know, formerly Twitter, to go after people that didn't agree with his actual Lou Elizondo account. So he would, and he got caught red-handed with his hand in the cookie jar, that didn't go over very well for him either. But I can understand where someone's trying to defend themselves and they can't do it as themselves. So they might want to create a alternate identity and go in and answer questions that he otherwise probably couldn't answer directly. I can see that, but that wasn't what it was utilized for. You know, it was utilized for much, I don't want to say the word nefarious, but we'll just say the activity that was done on that account and the corresponding accounts that go along with it, the information is being fed to was quite damning. And to myself, to several other people, I'll let them speak for themselves, but there's about, you know, there's the nefarious five people that he mentioned, and I'm one of those people, and not cool. But my criticism of him has not been guided by anything that he's done to me directly. It's still the same thing. I was doing all of this before then. I'm like you, dude. We talked about this before. If I'm going to believe in something, if someone's going to tell me something is extraordinary, then extraordinary claims, yeah, require extraordinary proof. But at the same time, I want to make certain, absolutely certain, that if I'm going to believe in something, that it is actually what I'm being told that it is. Hmm. And so you've got to go that extra mile, you know?
Yeah.
And that's important. That's important.
Well, and that's absolutely just it, you know. Once again, it blows my mind actually thinking about that, because whenever you said the date, and I've said the date numerous times on air, but it always reminds me of the fact of, wow, that was 2 months after we met, like a month or so after we met. Because I remember I was on site. Yeah. Right after that, when he was, I was at family Christmas when that happened, and wild stuff. So, even the idea of it being that long, and you know, we would definitely not be having the conversations that we are having on the floor of Congress without. Without having those videos leaked, put out, whether they were leaked or whether they were put out on purpose, you know.
Yeah, either way.
Either way.
Yeah. Either way, I'm glad they came out.
Yeah.
It definitely pushed the talk forward. And we've got Congress involved. There's one side of the fence that says Congress was hoodwinked into falling for this stuff. And there's another side of the fence that believes that the government is holding all this information and disclosures imminent. And it's 3 months away. It's kind of like the doomsday thing where it keeps moving along.
Yeah.
But you and I are somewhere in the middle there. We're in the middle. We're going, okay, there's information that needs to be looked at. This, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have a UFO program or UAP program where it's like the Arrow program where things are looked at and scrutinized. But they need to have people like with the skill set that I have or Mick West has or some others that are out there have, or just have a group of people that just we all look at the images independently of each other. And under whatever guidelines that they want us to have under like a DD-255 condition, and we're ultra scrutinized on our not debunk but our analyzation of these images, and that's something that should be done. Just like when I go to a court case, it's the same thing, and that way, once it gets to the person that's going to make a decision, whether it be a senator, whether it be a person in the Department of Defense, where they have to act on the information that's being presented to them, then they need to know that this went through a rigorous vetting process before it got to them. And if Lou Elizondo is running around the country with this image of a mothership that actually turns out to be a chandelier, he has got to be thoroughly embarrassed by this. And I'm wondering, what is his response, actually going to be? That's gonna tell me what kind of man that's gonna tell me what kind of man we're dealing with.
Yeah, and so. I mean, I've seen very little online from him regarding this. It's pretty interesting. I mean, once again, there is the actual picture, folks. That was found by John Greenwald of Black Vault. The source of the image presented by Lou Elizondo. And once again, the idea that here's kind of a sad truth. Even to those that have served our country with valor, with good intent, within the security field, within the fields of intelligentsia, even in the quality of analyst, you don't have to be out there doing field work, on a knock list or something like that. you could be in an office doing analyst work, but it doesn't mean that 10 years down the line that you aren't still, quote, an asset. That you aren't still a lever that can be moved within a community.
Right.
Right. And that's kind of how I view this, is the idea that, ill-directed to begin with. Whoever gave him this gave it to him because they are a trusted person. And somebody
I would hope the person that took that image would have immediately recognized that, oh, look, that's the thing behind us, and not, if they took that image and knew what it was and then gave it to him just to see if it would fly by him, then that's something of a whole nother thing that he's going to have to handle with whoever his source is on that image. That's the thing there. But keep in mind that image, if you look at the one that Greenwald was looking at, that's part of a video. And I don't know if you've seen the actual video, but that video, he says a lot of things in that video that are also questionable. When you said that you have pilots that are had reported seeing that thing, and that it was the image was taken from the U.S. Embassy, which is not even on that side of town, these kind of things, man, it just gets really deep, and I kind of feel sorry for him in a way, even though him and I have had our goings.
And once again, Mike, I don't think it's the fact of he had these in his presentation to misrepresent. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't believe
I don't
so.
I don't think I have never held the hard fact that Lou Elizondo is a plant or anything like that. I have always questioned, well, yeah, you know, he was fully involved with Intelligentsia in that world. And, you know, could it be that he's still being used as a lever? Sure. You know,
well, my history with him is a little different. And keep in mind, I brought up the GoFast information to him a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
The information about that number one party balloon was brought up, you know, the one that Chris Mellon put up on the very first, you know, announcement that TTSA had. You know, so all of this stuff was given to them very early on. Especially when it comes to Lou. Lou and I had this huge protracted argument on Twitter about GoFast. You know, we went back and forth. I think I sent you some of the images from that. And in that argument, I was kind of dumbfounded. I'm like, well, you have five things that you told us you would never do that are on your page, and now I'm blocked from him. But it, you know, the very first one is he'll never lie, and I think it goes down the list. I don't have it in front of me, but you know, so these things are indicative of a person who is approachable, is a person that you can say, hey, I just want to let you know that this information that is being presented to us, you may have an issue with it here. And I sent him a DM first. I didn't do this in public first. I sent him a DM and said, hey, here's the math. Here's how I got the results I got with the math. And you guys may need to walk back the GoFast video. And the response I got was not what I was expecting at all. I was slammed. And then next thing you know, this sock account is attacking me left and right on Twitter. And I'm like, where did this guy come from? All of a sudden, this guy, you know, knows that I'm, you know, he asked me questions about Afghanistan and stuff like this, questioning my trying to save people in Afghanistan, ex-killing people there. And I was like, who is this guy? Why would he be questioning that? And then come to find out. So it's sad. And that's my personal bias. But beyond that, everyone that sees an image that's brought to them online, especially from a person in Lou's position, would probably assume that image has gone through some sort of process that people have done to figure out whether it's legit or not. But there are some people that are online that do push out images and videos and stuff like this of whatever comes their way. They don't care if it's real or not, or if it's
regularly. And you know, I will show on screen my example of that. The example that I have I show pretty regularly, and you can feel free to go back and watch this because you're, of course, on audio right now, Mike. But this is a video that I recorded that I show regularly whenever I'm guesting on shows. It's a multicolored orb moving around, dark in the middle, bright ring around it, moving energy around it, changing colors, things like that. It slowly moves from the top left of the screen to the bottom right. Beautiful, beautiful orb. Amazing. And if I was to post that on a group, Mike, with zero information, zero data, just recorded this in my backyard, I'd get a lot of response. I'd get a lot of cajolative response and a lot of response. It's like, I've seen those. Hey, those things hide in thunderstorms, you know, kinds of stuff. Yeah. But if I gave the data with it, like we had on GoFast, if I put on there, you know, right ascension, this many degrees, this date, this time of day, facing southwest, It'd be pretty quick to find out that that's the Dog Star Sirius that it's a video of, unfocused in my telescope, doing what it does, twinkling and changing colors. You know, it's just under motion. The only motion there is because I'm zoomed in on a telescope that's not locked in on target. So that's the actual rotational speed of the Earth that you're seeing move the star in the sky. As exaggerated by my telescope. But without those facts,
You end up at a presentation with this amazing video that was shot in the backyard of somebody's house in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, and that happens a lot, especially with the Nikon P900 and P1000. The amount of images I get from that one camera alone to look at is just amazing.
Well, it's just the fact of at what point do you stop asking the critical questions of a source? You know.
At what point do you stop asking? Lou would be that point. You would think that when he's presenting something, that would be the point that you would say, okay, well, obviously, if he's presenting it, it had to have gone through this rigorous vetting process.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the provenance of the image? Where did it come from? Where did it source from?
Right.
You know, stuff like that. And once again, you're one of those that I wouldn't doubt the fact you could slide one over the plate past me, buddy, you know, but it's simply because like there is that trust there. You know, and you have to. I reconsider that now. Not that I think you're shady or shifty, my man, but things like this make me reconsider. You know,
if it can happen to
Lou Elizondo,
if you imagine if you were a late night television host, you're a late night TV host. And your audience, I mean, there is a scalable thing here. I mean, at the level that you and I are at and some others, maybe we don't have the resources available to do a lot of that process that's probably necessary. But there is a certain point where you're going to be insured and you have to have liability insurance for defamation reasons and things like this and all this other stuff. And that's the point where I think he should probably be at. Where you know you're now beyond the scope of where you were before, and this image. I mean, we're not talking about an image that we're being told that this dot in the sky might be this or might be that. We are being told this image is of a mothership.
Yeah,
I mean there was no. If you saw the video, he's not saying. We don't know what this is. He's saying this is a mothership. It was chased by apparently some fighter pilots or whatever, and that he has information from them. And I would really love to see that because that would be amusing. And things like of this nature and how he handles this is truly going to be indicative of the type of person that we're dealing with. And we'll see how that comes out. I hope and wish him well.
Yeah. And same here. You know, I hold no ill will toward the man. Once again, I think that a lot of our conversation of where any of us in the world of capital D disclosure and that movement are sitting right now is a great deal due to him and things brought forth and his continued work. You know, same thing with people like Stephen Bassett. Those people are hugely and massively important to the cause because they stepped forward in a way that nobody else was willing to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, you have to look towards that. But the only thing is that, you know, the devil's advocate here is we can't excuse people that have that are at that level and allow them to do certain things. Obviously, the sock accounts on Twitter is a major issue. I mean, there's a ton of people that were affected by that. You know, I did a 4-hour spaces thing last week or so about that specific issue. And there's a lot of people that were affected by it, and myself included.
Yeah.
And I was dragged across the coals, and some other new accounts were created because of it. And it's just like really wild.
Yeah.
But that's my issue, you know, so I have to deal with that.
Sure.
But I have to remember that this person is presenting this chandelier as a mothership. Now, from this point forward, it will always be a question when he brings something forward. And I hope like hell that he would hire someone like myself. I'll even do it for him for free. He can send me anything he has. I will do it for free, even though he and I had beef before. I would do it for free just to make certain that what he presents is legit and also to get a chance to see stuff for the first time really fast. But other than that, I have no problem with that. But will he do it?
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, even I discuss it regularly whenever I'm on other shows with hosts
We even as hosts have an onus thrust upon us, Mike, to keep things as real and as grounded as possible. We can hypothesize. We can talk about things. Yeah. We can talk about people's experiences. We can talk about the research going on into not only the experiences, but the fields. However, we've got to keep things as grounded as possible, because otherwise, the people who follow us, the people who listen to us, the people who trust us as a source are now led down that wrong path, you know?
And granted, you and I both have the same issue where some of the information that we report, if it's not sensationalized, it doesn't get a lot of traction out of it. People love to see things that there are just outlandish, you know, and stuff like that. But when it comes down to, you know, being rooted, like you're talking about, where we have to have 1 foot in true reality here and say, hey, let's slow down a minute and let's analyze this and see what this really is. But then as you and I sit there and we watch this story go around the world many, many times, oh, wow, we get this and this and this, and we both know what it is. You know, no one knows about Go Fast, Hardly. Very few people know that it's been truly, absolutely almost with 99.99999% assurity that thing is thoroughly debunked.
Yeah.
But how many people know that? And they still report it to this day, the same thing. So no one, even in the mainstream media, researches this stuff and says, oh, by the way.
A lot of people don't know that because they were unwilling to watch the NASA panel, Mike. And that's that's kind of the exact, you know, fish swallowing the hook, bait and all. Not getting caught in your lip. Like
you're just person to put.
Yeah. Yeah. You yeah. just suck
the
bait.
The first person to put the information out is the one that wins. You know, the one that puts the salacious information out and it gets its traction. Once they're done with that, they can walk away from it. And then they don't care anymore because they, you know, bad publicity, good publicity, doesn't really matter. They've got the publicity. And then the person that comes in behind it and says, oh, by the way, you know, when, how many times have you opened up a newspaper and read the retractions?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It just really doesn't happen. So it's unfortunate. But, you know, like a lot of people, the Thomas Walton story, you know, you and I both probably grew up absolutely believing every single word of that. And then we hear, and I would love to interview Travis Walton myself. And I still hang on to that original story. But then you've got the other stories that are out there, and it's a really hard pill to swallow. It really is. At least I got Barney and Betty Hill. I can still deal with that one.
But even that story. Even that one, though, was called into question by Stephen Greer. You know, and
let me have that one.
even the experience of de Cuellar, the UN General Counsel, Inspector General, that witnessed the Manhattan UFO abduction. He said that his experience was my lab's. Even with those, you know, you have once again these divisive wedges, and I will question it. I will throw the question out there. I'm no grand conspiracy theorist or anything like that. However, and I do not believe that correlation is causation. All right, folks. However,
you say that
when you start looking at things like this Lou Elizondo situation that's happening currently right now, which may have pulled brakes on his speaking tour about such subject. You know, when you look at this Manhattan UFO documentary that now has lawsuits pending against it for not just defamation of character, but for deceptive practice in getting these people on
are
camera.
Are we allowed to talk about those yet?
You know? Oh, absolutely. No, the lawsuit's and loud and proud. Like they made public announcement. There has been press release done, all kinds of stuff. It is out there.
Yeah, the
lawsuits are absolutely happening right now as we speak in Manhattan Superior Court. So good for them good for them, because once again, as we covered with Earl Grey, this is a wedge in the abduction community and in the abductee community. Yeah. And when you have these things debunked, when you have people like Lou Elizondo, somebody that people have come to trust in this community, debunked for something like this, you know, it makes people not want to come to him with other accounts. It makes people.
Yeah. Well, if there's a good thing about this, is this his mothership UFO image is not, doesn't have a personal experiencer attached to it. It's not like a person, an individual that believed that happened is going to be truly and detrimentally hurt by this.
No, so that, but the cause in and of itself that's still is. The cause in and of itself still is, and the tarnish on his reputation removes part of his provenance, you know, and it's not necessarily the fact that it's a major blow to the infrastructure that is the disclosure community, but it's one more chip on the base, you know, and when you get enough chips on the base, the infrastructure is cracked, and when it's cracked, it's not stable. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of question whether or not these things are being done within these communities to destabilize the movement.
And you're exactly right. And with that being a possibility, he should be even more suspect of when someone gives him information. You know, again, he could avoid all of this. The very first time I spoke with him, I DM'd him and told him I would be willing to analyze anything they have. He can read me into any program. It's not not even an issue. If he's an NGO, I'm an NGO too. We can be read in. Not a big deal. You know, it happens all the time. And then once that happens, then I can say, oh, this is crap. Don't put this out there, and save him the headache of doing it, or have a panel, you know, three or four people you have to work with people that you may not even like. If he doesn't like me, that's fine. He doesn't have to like me, but at least the work stands on itself. I've never had anything I've ever debunked been debunked. So with that track record, he should go, damn, Turber's got a track record of never having his debunk debunked. So let's run with him at least on this one image, and let's run with McWest, or let's run with Metabunk, and let's run, you know, with these other organizations or these places. Let's have SCU that can do this stuff as well. And then look at the data as it comes back. There's tons of people that will do this for free. I'll do it for free. Not a problem. Just so that this stuff moves forward in a way that it should. So that we're looking at stuff that we're being told it what it is. And at least I could say, I don't know what it is. And then that is in and of itself me going, it could be. And it's a lot better than saying, this is a chandelier.
Yeah.
A lot better than saying that.
Well, and you know, it's one of those that, once again, should give everybody in the community pause and pause for concern. Yeah. It should give everybody in the community pause. I don't care whether it's UFO, UAP related, whether it's cryptid related, whether it is paranormal related. It should give all of us pause to put another layer of vetting on what is brought to us. Not necessarily experientially, but data wise. When somebody presents data, you know, and examining that data and how we look at that data and how we vet that data, you know, because it did not, once again, take John Greenwald that long to find the Facebook group that came from. You know?
Yeah.
The story was that it was Google taken in 2022. Ends up, it's a post from 2023 being shared in 2024. So yeah, it's one of those, we have to be careful with these things. I say it regularly on the show. Evidence is what exonerates you in court. Never let it be less than that. If you would not give this photo to your defense attorney to keep you out of prison, you should reconsider it as, quote, evidence, and just call it data, because that's what it is.
Yep.
It's data. You know, he could have said, here's one that we were provided that we're still investigating, whatever. Much like with, as we covered whenever we talked about the Gaia lawsuit, you know, with Corey Good, the idea that, hey, I have people on my show who say on air, like, hey, spirit is telling me something. You know, this information is being channeled to me actively while we're on air. He never said his stuff was channeled. He said it was. And when you say it is, that's a different thing, you know, and you're liable to a different realm of accountability then. And when you say that this image is, this is something that was captured out in 2022, now you're responsible for a false statement. And he has come out on Twitter and said, you know, that he was duped, all that kind of stuff. You know, I had it up on screen just a minute ago. A photo that was provided to me by a friend in government a couple of years ago was presented by me 2 days ago at our engagement in Philadelphia. The former head of Defense Department's secret UFO tracking program wrote, referencing a private event in the city of Brotherly Love that took place in earlier that week. So, yeah, like he's already come out and said that, you know, but what I presented was given to me by somebody 2 years ago. And apparently it is not.
And truth be told, that was a private event.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he was making a public announcement that this had happened, but people paid to go to that event.
Yeah.
Now, if I paid to go to an event only to find out that one of the main I don't know what the entire subject matter is of the event, but if that was one of the main things, the takeaways from the event, I'm sure someone would go, wow, that was the main takeaway from the event, because we saw an image of a mothership. And I'm sure these people that went to this event probably left there saying, wow, we got to see an image that no one's ever seen before and things of that nature. Come to find out that it's a chandelier, man, I would be upset. I would be upset. So, you know, to help prevent this in the future, he's got to go through that extra step of vetting these things. And this is mistake 101. I mean, he should not make a mistake at this level of the game, this type of mistake. I mean, I can understand other things, but this is just too much.
Well, you know, and once again, I don't think it was done for any nefarious means on his side. I don't think that was the case.
I think
he was transmitted some bad information by somebody and used it because he trusts them, you know. And once again, that is the topic here tonight, is how do you rebuild that kind of trust? How do you, at what point does your generalized process of intake halt because of that level of trust?
Just like you and I both have our mission statements and the things that we fall back on, that you know, if I'm reporting something, I'm going to report the truth. If I make a mistake, I'm going to come back and I'm going to report that either A, I was given bad information, or B, I screwed up myself.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that before. Obviously my hoax thing, I came out and I said, look, this is wrong. I cannot do this. And so these issues are something that he's going to have to do. He's going to have to reformulate whatever foundation and whatever situation that he is in, where he has this process of putting out these little seminars as he goes around and does these things, that he's going to have to piece together a program that if something doesn't fit in a certain criteria or pass the smell test or whatever, that it has to go through a rigorous process before he starts putting it out to the public, especially when you're charging people for it. That's key. You know, if you put out information and no one paid for it, no harm, no foul. But you know, there's a whole nother level that he's at, and he's going to have to step it up. That's understood, I think.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on, for breaking this down, for really digging into it, especially as somebody who works in the world of security, works in the world of intelligentsia. I think it's important for people to understand that kind of scope when it comes to this, and how, once again, how easily it happens. And even the fact of if you're retired, if you're gone and you're out in the public sector doing what you do and you have sources, doesn't mean you aren't still being leveraged. Doesn't mean you aren't still being baited on a string to dance for them, you know, whether you realize it or not. So thank you so much as always. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to keep up with you, where they can go to find out the latest from 5x5 News, bud.
Sure. Probably the easiest spots would be YouTube would be one. That would be under the 5x5 News moniker. Same thing in Twitter, which would be 5x5 News. And on TikTok is where I'm going to start doing some lives and some little bit more focus on TikTok, because the algorithm still works for me there under my name as Mike Turber. T-U-R-B-E-R. So take a look at those and engage with me. If you have a question about anything I've investigated before, whether it be UFOs, Las Vegas shooting, or whatever, Tiger King, it doesn't matter. I'm an open book. I'm more than happy to talk to you.
All right. Well, Mike, hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Thanks so much as always, brother.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Thank you, buddy.
While you are online checking out all the amazing work of Mike Turber and 5x5 News, stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to find all of our guests' YouTube channels. They are all conveniently located right there for you to watch, follow, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. Make sure while you're on CuriousRealm.com that you like, follow, subscribe, share, comment, everything else. And of course, make sure to visit Curious Research. CuriousResearch.org is our new endeavor to prepare the worlds of UFO, UAP studies, cryptozoology research, paranormal research, preparing all of these fields to shake hands with science with their data. So stop on by there and buy our all new field observation and encounter log available at Curious Research. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your time always. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.